Welcome, everybody. It's like on Zoom. It's nice to not be leading something hybrid. Almost everything I do now, I have a computer screen with people there and people in front of me. So now just people in person. You're welcome to come grab a tech study package. For those, let's see. Can I fling them up there?
Sure.
I can make paper airplanes. So I thought we'd start with a song today, because I'm not going to be here Thursday night, and we thought it would be nice to share a song from the Jewish tradition during the faculty vespers. And so I'm Rabbi Johanna Huber from Olympia and Kirkland, Washington. I live in Olympia, I live in Kirkland, where my congregation is. And this song, very popular, newer, probably maybe like 7 years old, song written by Rabbi Menachem Creditor, who I believe might be in Oakland, but in that area. And the words, the Hebrew words are olam, meaning olam, the world, chesed, a loving kindness, yibaneh, I will build. Or, I will build a world of loving kindness. So olam, chesed, yibaneh, and then the English part is, I will build this world from love. If we will build this world from love, then God will build this world from love. And it's like this. So it starts out with some oohs. Ooh, ya da 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 da, ya da da da. Ooh, ya da 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 da, ya da da da. One more time. Ooh, ya da da. So much for participating and for starting to learn this song, and so hopefully we'll have an opportunity to sing this at Vespers with everyone. So welcome to Shemitah or Yovel throughout the ages. And we're going to start with a definition of what Shemitah is, or the sabbatical year, from Hazon, the organization Hazon. They teach that commonly translated as the sabbatical year, Shemitah literally means release. Of biblical origin, this is the final year of a shared calendar cycle, when land is left fallow, debts are forgiven, and a host of other agricultural and economic adjustments are made to ensure the maintenance of an equitable, just, and healthy society. The questions about how Shemitah actually worked, if it actually worked, are enormous. The possibilities for social change are thrilling. So I want to preface this by saying that we don't have any evidence that this actually ever happened the way it's described or discussed in the Jewish tradition. So while it is put out there in the Torah, and we know the people went into the land, we do not have anything concrete that says, and this is how it worked, and this is why it was difficult, or this is, it's so, in many ways, this was theoretical, and it's so powerfully theoretical that we are still debating and talking and wrestling and feeling thrilled by the possibilities of the justice that could possibly ensue in this world if this was applied. So sometimes it's not about that it actually happened. Often when we're talking about the Bible, it's not about whether it actually happened or not, but the ideas, the concepts that come to us that we attribute with divine living, divine societal building. So the Shemitah happens every 7 years. Debts are forgiven. That's a mind-blowing concept that every 7 years debts would be forgiven. So we can think about what that means societally. And all the land of Israel, and again, these laws were designed specifically for living in the land of Israel. The land lies flower, it may not be worked, meaning no planting or harvesting of the food for the year. And all produce that does grow, like grapes on trees and grapes on the vine, it's considered hekfer, which means that it may be picked and eaten by anyone. So if we just want to imagine just for a second what that might look like, say in our country, if actually applied, just those basic concepts, it would probably blow up our whole reality, right? And definitely our whole economic system. And then the Yovel year, and this is actually my Yovel year, I'm turning 50 in November, so 7 by 7, this is my Yovel year. The land of Israel continues to lie fallow, it may not be worked like Shemitah. All Jewish slaves go free in the text, and all land in Israel that was purchased is returned back to the original owner. So for example, if you had to sell your house because could no longer afford to keep it, but it was important family land, in the Yovel year, it would be returned, and you could redevelop the relationship with your family land. We turn the page, and I put here, for purposes of sharing Jewish civilization with you all, the Hebrew names for the books of the Bible that we're going to be looking at. So the first text on page 2 is from Vayikra, and that's what we call Leviticus. And the Lord spoke to Moshe on Mount Sinai, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land that I shall give you, the land shall observe a Shabbat of the Lord. For 6 years you may sow your field, and for 6 years you may prune your vineyard, and you may gather its crop. But on the seventh year, a complete rest shall be for the land, a Shabbat for the Lord. Your field shall not sow, and your vineyard you shall not prune. You shall not reap the wilds of your harvest or gather the grapes of the vines which you set aside. It shall be a year of complete rest for the land. But you may eat whatever the land during its Shabbat will produce. you and your male and female servants, the hired workers and those who live with you, and for your animal and for the wild beast that is in your land, shall all its crop be to eat." So it means that if you live in the Northwest and you have a garden, you have all those fences up to keep out the bunnies and the deer. Those fences come down. All the wild beasts, the bunnies and the deers and the chipmunks, like here, the chipmunks could just, you know, go wild. Eat whatever, take over. Chipmunk colony, 50-pound chipmunks. So the animals have full access, also wild animals. And from the book of Exodus, which we call Shemot, 6 years you shall sow your land and gather its yield, but in the 7th year you shall let it rest and lie fallow. Let the needy among your people eat of it, and what they leave, let the wild beasts eat of it. You shall do the same with your vineyards and olive groves. So does anybody have a question or a comment or a statement from, it might not be your first, but today's interaction with these two texts from the 5 books?
I would, but I don't know very much about, you know, from the different traditions, so forgive me if it doesn't make sense.
No, please.
But in this first section here in Vayikra, it mentions the Lord's men speaking to Moshe on Mount Sinai, and it seems kind of, it's directly from, you know, the Lord to Moshe to, you know, the children of Israel, and you mentioned that it was never actually implemented.
We don't have any evidence.
Oh, okay. So it may
have
been
evidence,
but we don't know what it was like.
Yeah.
I see.
Although, I mean, they did like to write and reflect a lot. So we feel like the one thing that we do know is there's a rabbinic text that says, how do you know if someone is a reliable witness in a court of law? Like, what are the things that make them to be considered a reliable witness? And this is probably, I don't know, maybe the 2nd or 3rd century, what they say is they're aware of where we are in the Shemitah cycle. Mm-hmm. They could say this is year 3 or year 5. So it must have been a concept for keeping time and for the economy that if someone was aware of it, it meant that they were a particularly pious person. Did it actually happen like this? What we know from today, because of the modern state of Israel, is that they do try to keep Shemitah, but it's not that radical justice. You know, there's been ways to frame it so that it's not as radical. So I believe that it was never truly implemented with the full justice measures that it was, because we probably would have heard about it. They would have written about it and told us. Anyone else? Questions, comments?
So if this is very technical, but if my crops fail and I needed to feed my family and it's year three and I go into some debt to some other families, I would know that at year 7 that debt would be forgiven and they would know it too.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating to think through, like, how that would work in practice. Like,
Right.
It's going to be, yeah.
Because people will say, you know, well, they know that you're not going to pay them back, right? Or that this will be...
Right.
So we start getting really quickly, when we talk about Shemitah, yeah, into the nature of the human soul,
yeah,
and
right,
how we, yeah, function and move through this world.
Yeah.
Because it seems so implausible that human beings,
yeah,
could actually do this. That we could let what we lent to someone, we could say in the 7th year, it's gone. We return something that we purchased to the original owner. What?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead.
If you're only offering 6-year mortgages, then if you're only offering 6-year mortgages, do you know what kind of person it is?
Right. Exactly. That gives you a lot of information,
yes,
too.
So it seems that debt becomes a matter of being reciprocal, in a sense. And it also brings up the question of what's good enough.
Yes. Yes, reciprocity and what is good enough. Absolutely. Anyone else? Yeah, go ahead.
Is there a concept of saving for the seventh year? Like, do you store grain away, or is that not allowed? I mean, do you really just live off of like whatever you can gather in the seventh year, or can you stock up?
You can stock up. You can stock up. It's just they didn't have the same. You do have to plan. Mm-hmm. So there's certain things you would need to stock up on, mm-hmm. like olive oil and things. Right. You also have to plan that for the future, and that there's not going to be a yield from that year. So what do you do in year eight?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's, yeah, so there's all this planning for how to accommodate this justice measure for society, this check on how equitable and just of a society we are, and everybody's preparing for that. Mm-hmm. But it does seem that there's a sense that human nature is very different of how we think about it, because the system is based on, at least, or this is based on the idea that people would do this, and that they have the hearts and the minds to actually follow through with something. So we know God believes in us, that we are capable, that we can get here, but we have been talking about it for thousands of years. Anyone else before we move on? Yes, go ahead.
One thing I notice is that the land needs to rest in the same way that people.
Yes.
And that the land is working really hard for 6 years, giving us everything. And that it uses the word Shabbat. It's a Shabbat, too. Now, maybe it can't do it every 7 days, but the land gets that same rest that people deserve. Mm. So the land is a living thing.
Yeah.
And not just this mineral thing, but this living thing that also needs repose.
Yeah, that takes us right back to creation story, that all aspects of creation need to rest and renew and revitalize, and that there's a life breath to the planet also. That's a pretty amazing concept to for all of us to inherit. Thank you, Minor.
So I'm still thinking about the issue of land and debt and so on. Mm. So, I mean, one thing is that, I mean, I'm thinking about like co-housing, where the land that is the commons and your house on the land, that's, you know, the land underneath the house is not yours. I don't know if that has any relevance, but I'm thinking, who is the original owner?
God.
How far back do you go? Well,
you can't own land really in Israel. You never can really, really own it forever.
Yeah.
Yeah, it never really belongs to you. It always belongs to God. We're just renting. And so, and we have to take care of that land too, because we're tenants.
Stewards.
Yeah.
Stewards, yeah. And in the Jewish story, you could also be kicked out of or spit out of the land if you don't treat it well, that you will be rejected for not doing the things that we committed to do, at least at that Sinai moment. So in there's a medieval text, Kli Yakar, and this is a commentary on Devarim, which is what we call Deuteronomy. And if they write, the year of Shemitah, again, medieval text, so we had not practiced this even a little bit for a very long time, because this can only be practiced in the land of Israel. But we continue to discuss it and debate it at length for hundreds and hundreds, actually thousands of years. So the year of Shemitah promotes a sense of fellowship and peace through the suspension of cultivation. Even for the needy of your people, for one is not allowed to exercise over any of the seventh year produce the right of private ownership. This is undoubtedly a primary factor in promoting peace, since most dissension originates from the attitudes of mine is mine, one person claiming it is all mine, and the other also claiming it is all mine. But in the seventh year, all are equal, and this is the real essence of peace. So even though in the medieval era, Jews may have been living, you know, different places all over the world, and they knew this isn't even a possibility. We can't enact this because we're not living in the land of Israel, but we still talk about it and think about what the values are that we're inheriting from these ideas. And that's important enough, just to bring them into our heart, debate them, talk about them, and cultivate the kind of world we want, even though we're not in the promised land. Any comments, questions, ideas that come from this text?
The last sentence is reminds me of an interpretation of the one of the first verses in the first chapter of our book. The concept of everyone being equal is a powerful one. Everyone's on the same plane.
And society imposing that so we can even see what it looks like? because we don't know what that looks like, so we have to have a structure to show us. But interestingly enough, it doesn't demand that we live like this all the time. It's a correction for society. We're not looking for, at least in these texts, to live in Olam Haba, the world to come, the paradise. That's not it. This is in this world, in our world. Anybody else on this text? Kli Yakar, which means precious vessel. That's what they called the rabbi, precious vessel. Okay, well then we will move on to...
I think it's beautiful that, I think there's deep insight here that when our neighbors are hungry, and when there is inequity economically and people are... this beautiful vessel said it well here, right?
Here, it's interesting to talk about private ownership.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, for those of us who have questions about capitalism and how it functions in our world, you know, the idea that no private ownership of food sources is allowed one out of every 7 years. Any thoughts about private ownership and how that functions in our world? And how, is that a spiritual challenge for us?
So what does this mean when corporations try to patent natural things?
That would be interesting
and
to see. Yeah.
Which applies to a lot of things that are food or traditional medicines or other necessities where, you know, ownership is stuck onto that thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's been one of the big struggles around the world. Mm-hmm. So how does this fit into that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And control mm-hmm. and ownership of things that are essential for human life and for life of the planet.
Well, ownership in this sense is different, and it's a deviation from the concept of our right.
Mm-hmm.
You can have rights to land even if you don't own it.
Yes.
And that was at the center of the disparity between European ideas of land ownership and First Nations ideas of land ownership.
Yeah.
They didn't have ownership, they had rights.
Mm-hmm.
They could fish there, they could pick berries there, they mm-hmm. could do things like that. And somebody else could be picking berries in the next little patch. You know, so that it was non-exclusive in terms
mm-hmm.
of... the exclusivity is the issue here.
Yes.
It's all mine.
Mm-hmm.
America's a very extreme version of that, because I found mm-hmm. out that in like Sweden, people have the right to cross over other people's lands to get from one place to another. That might be the case in other Europeans around the world. Definitely is not here.
No.
If you cross over someone's land, you could be shot, and
yeah.
they would be completely justified in shooting you. So we have so much private ownership in this country.
Mm-hmm.
This is such a challenge to our way of thinking.
This is, derail. There's this really funny story I heard from a modern Muslim scholar called Hamza Yusuf. He's a fascinating guy. he left America to go study in North Africa amongst a specific group of kind of like semi-nomadic scholars. And they were Berbers, right? They're basically nomads that are running around. And so when he was studying with them, they'd have this like one large communal water vessel in the center of camp that they would all be like using. And he didn't want to run out of water, so he'd go up and he'd take his little water bottle and he'd like fill it up. And all of the Bedouins would like laugh at him, like, haha, Hamza thinks he owns the water.
That's amazing. You know what's really weird that you told that story is that I'm Berber. Oh. My mom is a Berber Jew from the Low Atlas Mountains.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, which is an interesting Berber connection. So we have this text from the medieval era of Jewish civilization. So we have our biblical text. I didn't include the rabbinic text because they dive so deep into all the details. What they really want to think about is how to apply this. But they're not in a position to apply it. But they want to think about how to apply it and ask all the questions about, like, well, what if this and what if that? And can you forage, for example? Yes, you can. Foraging is okay. So part of the wisdom and knowledge that you would have is that you would know how to forage in your society and what to look for on that year. And that also creates a really different relationship to the land. Suddenly, you're a forager. And you're going to be making, and this is what I imagine, is that there were special dishes that you would only make through foraging, and that those were really celebratory. I'm just writing my own personal narrative into the text, imagining what it would be like. But that's what I think, is that we would go, and so I imagine, what would I do here on the Shemitah year if I was a forager? And what kinds of meals would we make from only foraged foods for our celebrations? And going throughout, because there's still Shabbat, there's still all the holidays, so they're celebrating. This is a year of rest for everyone, so everybody on your land would also be not working. Your land workers would get a year off. They would get to just live off the land along with you. What do you think that would be like? Suddenly the people who work for you on your land are also resting. What does that do to your brain? And your idea about your land and your wealth and who you are in the world? Or if you're a worker, let's also imagine that you're the worker of the land. What does that do to you as a worker, knowing that you have ahead of you a full year of rest and rejuvenation? What is your relationship to your work? You would also get Sabbath too. So while in the rabbinic era they're very interested in all the details and the laws, I'm interested in the psychology of it. Mm-hmm. I'm interested what this applied would do to human minds and systems. Rav Kook, and this is a modern text from the modern era of Jewish civilization, writes, and this is, I'm reading on page 3, life can only be perfected through the affording of a breathing space from the bustle of everyday life. Do you all agree with that? That's what Holden sort of all about. The individual shakes themselves free from the ordinary weekday life at short and regular intervals on every Sabbath. What the Sabbath achieves regarding the individual, and this is what you were saying earlier, the Shemitah achieves with regard to the nation as a whole. A year of solemn rest is essential for both the nation and the land. A year of peace and quiet without oppressor and tyrant. It is a year of equality and rest in which the soul reaches out towards divine justice, towards God who sustains the living creatures with loving kindness. There is no private property, no punctilious?
Yeah.
I think punklicious sounds really
punk-licious
good.
Sounds good.
But privilege, but the peace of God reigns over all in which there is the breath of life. Sanctity is not profaned by the exercise of private acquisitiveness, over all this year's produce. And the covetousness of wealth stirred up by commerce is forgotten. For food, but not for commerce. Any thoughts about this text? So first he says that life can only be perfected, that cleaving to the divine, that coming to the messianic era, through the affording of breathing space for the bustle of everyday life. Any thoughts about breathing the space?
Well, you know, I'm thinking about not only how does this apply on the cycle, but how certain of these ideas apply all the time. I mean, we're all, and it's interesting to hear the term breathing space because, among other things, a lot of our troubles, like COVID, come from humans pushing into places so that the natural world has no breathing space, which makes it a lot easier for certain things to get passed back and forth and cause crises. But you go back to that impulse for profit and to push into. So the idea of giving breathing space seems so necessary and radical.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thinking about, you know, embers and fire, and that if they're too close together, it burns out. If they're too far apart, the fire burns out. But if they're right next to each other in the right way, we have this ongoing energy. Anyone else about breathing space? And
well, the breath of life, right? Mm-hmm. So was breathed into, right? Into life, right? And so what this is suggesting is that we are squeezing the breath of life out of ourselves, each other, and the earth.
Yes, I would say that would be a very good interpretation, yes. And then it says the individual needs to shake themselves free of the ordinary weekday life in short and regular intervals. So every seventh day. And that the Shemitah achieves this for the nation as a whole. That this year has the same transformational and life-sustaining value that it has for the individual on a weekly basis. This is for the whole nation. Any thoughts about that? That a nation can transform and renew? A year of solemn rest is essential for both the nation and the land. So they're not just talking about the land, they're talking about the citizenry. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Citizenry of the, that there's a Shemitah for them too. So the land is resting, but society is also. Mm-hmm. I mean, gosh, America, oh, could we use a Shemitah here? Just so many people working so hard all the time. And that, then he makes the connection that this is a year of peace and quiet without oppressor and tyrant. Mm-hmm. A year of equality and rest, where we have the space for the soul to reach and understand divine justice and understand where all the loving kindness and energy is coming from. And that is achieved through no private property, understanding our privilege, understanding that God reigns over all in which there is the breath of life. Now, Ralph Cook was by no means a radical, yet he's bringing forth a very radical notion. Any other thoughts about this text?
I'm struck by the phrase covetousness of wealth, because to me that harkens back to the commandments, and you know, you should not covet, blah, 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 or at least use that same kind of language, you know, in the commandments. And so there's something about how the desire for wealth is not healthy. But you know, in that phrase, and I don't think that's not our normal ideology. Our normal ideology is wealth is a good thing, and the more wealth, the better. And the people that we admire are the ones who are at the top of the wealth. You know, and so this kind of turns that on its head and says maybe wealth is not a good thing.
Or unchecked.
Yeah.
You know, and that there have to be checks in there.
Yeah.
Because I would say the other 6 years. At least from the Jewish tradition, it's okay to have wealth and to, you know, invest and do with all the capitalist things. But there's a check in that, and on that 7th year or on that, you know, 50th year, that there will be, society will transform, and what you think is yours and your might and your glory really isn't. And so you have to live with the full knowledge of that humbling year is about to come.
I think what this is saying is that wealth is an addictive drug.
Mm.
So you have to go cold turkey for a year.
And the thing, but this is just for food. So that's also here at the end. He makes sure that this exercise is really, it's about food, and it also is wealth because people who own the, you know, the vineyards, and in ancient times that would have been really important. That who was owning the land, but it's not for all commerce. So why? I mean, why food? What is it? Why? What? How is the food system being changed so disruptive that it can lead us to this transformational place?
Well, in the days of subsistence farming, that was commerce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agriculture was a much more significant part of the economy until several hundred years ago. Mm-hmm.
They were producing and processing and storing most everything they needed by household,
right.
Mm-hmm. And then commerce was simply what your family was maybe good at, mm-hmm. you could trade with another couple of families that were good at something else, and kind of everything would even out.
Mm-hmm. So here in this in the Shemitah year, they would still be trading, but they would be trading what they had in abundance for what others. So if you, for example, you have an apple, like this area, apples and pears, and you can, you know, they're falling, you're collecting them, but you can't sell them. You obviously can't eat them all. So, but what you can do is put them on the side of the road, and as people come by, they will collect what they need. And then your neighbor has a whole bunch of cabbage, or whatever it was that's coming, something perennial, and so they put their stuff out on the side of the road because it's going to rot. There's nothing, you can't do anything with it, and so then everybody gets to just take what they need from their neighbor, and in theory it all works out, mm-hmm. and everybody is fed and sustained, but using very different human means for doing that. It's just, it's about generosity and abundance. That's the basis of the agricultural cycle. Anyone else before we move into the next text? So the next text from 2003, and Judith Shulevitz, Bring Back the Sabbath. We're getting into contemporary texts. So we did Biblical, medieval, modern, and now contemporary. And she writes, I often think of something two rabbis said. Rabbi Judah Lo of Prague, best known for his tales of the golem, pointed out that the story of creation was written in such a way that each day, each new creation, is seen as a step toward a completion that occurred on the Sabbath. What was creation's climatic culmination? An act of stopping. Why should God have considered it so important to stop? Rabbi Elijah of Vilna put it this way. God stopped to show us that what we create becomes meaningful to us only once we stop creating it and start to think about why we did so. The implication is clear. We could let the world wind us up and set us to marching like mechanical dolls that go and go until they fall over because they don't have a mechanism that allows them to pause. But what would make us establish trust? Oops, excuse me. What would make us less than human? Excuse me. We have to remember to stop because we have to stop to remember. We have to remember to stop because we have to stop to remember. So I know in my congregation, that's the work of Shabbat. When we welcome in Shabbat, we consider everything that happened during the week and the work that we did as co-creators of this reality with the divine. And we allow ourselves to let go of those things we don't want to bring forward and to also let rise to the top, like cream, all the goodness that we brought into our lives and was brought into our lives this during the week. And so we think about the why of our lives and the how of our lives and the gratitude for what happened in the week. And that's the pausing and the stopping. This then for Shemitah would be for the nation. So if we stopped and we thought about the why of what we are, what would happen? You don't have to, I mean, this is sort of just a throwing out there question, Reiner?
So I'm curious about something, and this has to do with Sabbath and Shemitah. In our home, it's what I'll call a serious joke that on Sabbath, Deb and I were perfect.
You're perfect, yeah.
Like, you know, we're the perfect partners for each other on Sabbath. You know, we may have our issues the rest of the week, but the Sabbath gives us a chance just to step back and just be perfect. Is there an idea like that that gets applied to Shemitah?
Well, I think the idea...
Is that too woo-woo in a way to grab onto, or is there an idea?
Well, the rabbis, you know, the rabbinic era, they really enjoyed the concept of 1/60th. And so there's a lot of rabbinic texts that talk about this is 1/60th of that. Like sleep is 1/60th death. Dreams are 1/60th prophecy. And we also learn that Shabbat is 1/60th of Olam Haba, the world to come, that you get to feel, you get to experience a little teeny taste of paradise on the Sabbath. So yes, and I would say that the Shemitah years also, and the Yovel, designed to help us understand what the world could possibly look like that we're trying to build. Without it being, you know, we have to get there. God's not going to do it for us.
So, and allowing us to stop so we can we have the power of memory. Like in a relationship, we can remember why we got into that relationship.
In the first place.
It seems, yeah, these ideas are really expansive, as you're saying.
Well, and that's the ketubah, and also in Islam, they have is it katab, the marriage document that you sign? The Islam and Judaism both have the same word, and it's a marriage document, and that's what I always tell couples, is that when you keep it on the wall of your house, so that when you forget why you did this, you can go reread it, and that's the covenant that you signed with your beloved, and on Shavuot, on the holiday of, what's it called in Christianity? Is it Pentecost?
Yep.
Yes. Yeah, Pentecost. It was traditional Jewish communities would rewrite their ketubah, their marriage contract with God. So that the Jewish people are in this same kind of loving relationship with God. And Shabbat is also the time where, and in the Kabbalistic tradition, the divine masculine and feminine come together. And there is that unity and that rejoicing and also renewal. So yes, we could go, I mean, yes, there's connections. So many connections. But there's a covenant as part of this. And so in the Torah, these laws were covenantal, meaning I will take care of you and the land will flow and all will be good if you do these things. So if we did these things, we probably would be experiencing a very different reality, one more, much more flowing with divine love and care of each other and the planet. And so we consider for a moment, what would this look like for us? What could it look like for us? I mean, does America need to pause and think about why did we do this in the first place with our economic systems? How did we get here? We don't have the time to pause because it's hard to change the wheels while the bus is rolling. And that's why social change work could be so frustrating. And then we have, I'm going to move to this text number, the Nina Beth Carden text on page 4. Shemitah is not a call to live for 1 year with different rules that help us adjust or compensate for the inequitable or unequitable accumulation of debt or dissatisfaction and injustice of the other 6 years, only to dump us back unchanged into the real world. Shemitah, and this gets to what we were just discussing, is a rehearsal of a new way, a time to practice living in a world of enoughness, where each of us is filled and flourishes with enough, where disproportionate inequities would not and could not exist. And when Shemitah is over and we re-enter the other 6 years, we take a bit of what we learned with us and put it into practice in our everyday life. That is our frame for the story of Shemitah, a taste and a test of a world of sova, satiation, enough, in which we all pursue material and spiritual fulfillment, not through lowering our sights for desires, but through filling them rightly with and through the presence of each other. And I particularly like this text because it speaks to what you can build through Shemitah, what you can carry forward. And it gives us a little bit of an entree as contemporary people to think about how we can apply these values, even though we're not going to be able to do it the way it's described in the Torah, but that's okay. We don't do a lot of stuff the way it's described in the Torah. So really what we're going to hold on to here and cleave to are the concepts and the values that we've inherited that give us direction for how to build a better world. And so below what you'll see is practical ideas. Since we're in this year right now in the Jewish calendar cycle, these are things that some Jewish communities would be implementing in order to honor and get a taste of and a test of what is possible for Shemitah. So host a crop swap food barter, especially this season. So, I mean, just everybody bring what's in harvesting from their garden to share with each other, to feel that. I mean, imagine your church or mosque or synagogue parking lot where everybody is bringing something that they grew or made this season and sharing it with each other freely. Host a community swap meet, things that you have, that you own, that you are willing to release, which is Shemitah, the release. Host a gift circle. Host a community potluck feast. We do that a lot, I'm sure many of us anyways. Host a community visioning circle guided by the question, imagine what this community will look like 7 years from now, inspired by Shemitah values. Find out what your community's collective dreams, visions, and needs are. We cannot create change unless we have a collective vision we are working towards. And I think that's a really important concept for how we cultivate hope today, is to have a vision. Share your impressions through conversation, art, and movement. Divide into smaller groups so you can go deep into many areas. Host a Shemitah Council gathering. Building upon the feedback from your community vision circle, invite local community leaders, organizers, educators, rabbis, leaders to come together with the intention of exploring how to create a roadmap for a practical integration of Shemitah values and practices in your community. Host a reskilling fair. We are all teachers and students. Host a community crowdfunding gathering. Support ethical investing, spending, and banking. Join financial mentoring and investment circles. So from these practical suggestions for how to bring it into the year, into now, this year, what do you think is the issues that we most could possibly address? Thinking about some of these as being practical, like how can we bring Shemitah values? What might that look like?
In the U.S., people go into debt for all kinds of bare necessities, things like medical debt, education, right? And those things I've always thought of as almost like a modern-day indentured servitude, sort of pseudo-American slavery. And it can weigh heavy on the heads of most, you know, a huge portion of the population. So the idea of that being wiped out would be really cool.
So so you could maybe organize to wipe out debt, and that has been happening across the country, is that groups have been, medical debt especially.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the sort of swap meet gift circle thing reminds me of something that our daughter-in-law is involved in our suburb. There's this social media group of moms who, instead of accumulating things in the garage and having a garage sale, they just post it,
yeah,
like a stroller or a sports gear or whatever. And there's always some mom somewhere who needs one of those. Mm-hmm. And so it goes back and forth like that.
Yes. I mean, the social media has definitely enabled people to do a lot of sharing, you know, a whole economy that's not based in exchanging money. Yeah.
They have very simple rules. It has to be completely free, no selling, and you have to come and get it the same day.
Oh, that's okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Anyone else? So now Shemitah is in your head, I hope. These ideas that come, you know, sourced from, as we said at the beginning, from God, according to the story here, from God to Moses to the people. And what's important here, for me at least, is not whether it ever happened or not, but we're talking about it. And that since it becomes from this sacred text that's shared by Christians and Jews, there's a lot of people who could be talking about it, right? Because it's in all of our texts. We imagine if there was one weekend, Shabbat, where everybody was talking about Shemitah in this country from every pulpit, and what kind of brain change might happen in this country.
Well, and Jesus included the acceptable year of the Lord, you know, that's in the Christian scriptures. Right, so it's not just for Christians, like it is. It should be included in the work of the community. Right, it's it's included in the reign of God. So, you know, maybe we could spend a little more time paying attention to that.
Yeah, I mean, we're in the real time, like it's happening right now. This is the year.
Right.
So if you do go to Israel, you'll see that there are crops that are lying fallow. But there are also rabbinic loopholes for how to get out of that. And so what the majority of people who have a lot of ownership of land is that they'll sell it for the year, so that they are not the owners, but the land is still used. So there are ways, because human beings, we're very, very, you know, feisty monkeys. We like to find loopholes and ways to continue to push our, you know, our ego and our desire to, you know, use the land. So there are loopholes. So the people who are doing it in Israel right now, they're doing it for spiritual, moral, ethical reasons. They're not doing it for legal reasons, because they're legal loopholes. And so then again, imagine if you're really doing it not for legal reasons, but for spiritual, moral, ethical reasons, that how meaningful it would be to just open up your land and let anybody come and take what's growing and all the animals just feast away that you usually are keeping fenced out. And what kind of transformation happens for the human being when they let that happen in their lives? So thank you all so much. We're going to close with our song again. And if you ever want to talk about any of this, I'm here for the next few days. Happy to dive deep. If you go to hazon.org, it's on page number 1, Shemitah Project. There's actually like a 50-page source book with texts from all the eras of Jewish civilization about Shemitah. They go really, really deep, and there's discussion guides. And that is available to everyone. So if you want to bring more of this into your community, there are a lot of resources out there. And we will, again, turn our hearts and minds towards God's flow of loving kindness, chesed, in this world, and how we are here to also be co-builders, co-creators of a world filled with loving kindness. Ooh, ya da 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 da, ya da da da. Ooh, ya da 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 da, ya da da da. Ooh, ya da 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 da. Ya da 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 da, ooh, ya da 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 da, ya da da da. Olam, Olam, Chesed Yibane, ya da 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 da, ya da da da. Olam, Chesed Yibane. Return always to sacred learning spaces in peace. Have a wonderful day. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here again.